Welcome, listeners, to the Praemium Investment Leaders podcast. I'm your host, Damien Chilmey, Head of Investment Managers and Governance with Praemium, one of Australia's fastest growing platforms. Today, we have the great pleasure to be joined by Andy Rakes from TT International, who has joined us from their London office. In the program today, we're going to talk about environmental impact investing and doing it with purpose. Whilst the first iterations of their ethical investing focused on not doing anything bad, arguably, did it mean that you were necessarily doing something good? With greater focus and interest in this area, strategies have needed to develop and articulate their environmental outcomes. A little about our guest today. Andy Rakes is co-portfolio manager for TT's environmental strategy and head of European research. Andy joined TT in 2002 from Deutsche Asset Management, where he was director and head of global and retail and leisure team. Andy graduated from University of Oxford with a BA and a master's in engineering. And about TT International. The group was founded in London in 1988 and is a specialist high alpha equities global asset manager with a focus on style agnostic, high conviction investing. The group managed over $10 billion in funds under management, and the TT Global Environmental Impact Fund is distributed in Australia by Copia Investment Partners. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
And great to have you in Melbourne, and hopefully nicer weather than London. I understand there was some snow today, I think, in London.
That's right. In fact, my wife sent me a video yesterday of her frolicking around in the garden with some dogs in a lot of snow. So it's nice to be here in warmer climes.
Very good. Very good. So, well, let's get into it. And we'll just open up with, some context and scene setting throughout of this. And across the responsible investing spectrum, there's many terms and many acronyms out there. And I think you've added another one to the lexicon because you call this a solution strategy. So what do you mean by this?
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. There's definitely a lot of a jargon out there. So solution strategy for us means that we're only investing in companies that have a product or service that is solving an environmental problem. So we're not a low carbon strategy. So we're not investing in things like big tech because they've got a low carbon footprint. We're not a transition strategy. So we're not investing in big oil because they're investing a lot in renewables. Those strategies have their place, but it's absolutely not what we're doing. So we're only investing in companies that have a product or service that's making a significant contribution to solving an environmental problem. And also, I should say it's a very pure play strategy, investing in those solutions companies. So more than at least 80% of capital at any one time is invested in companies where the product or service that is solving the environmental problem is the majority of their business, i.e. more than 50% of revenue or profit. And then we have another bucket, which is up to 20% of the capital invested in the fund, is reserved not for having a free hit to invest in anything, but to invest in companies where they still have a product or service that's making a significant contribution to solving an environmental problem, but it's not yet the majority of their business. So,
you know, that 80% threshold that you talked about before.
So the 80% threshold applies to, that's the amount of capital of the fund at any one time where we're investing in companies where the product or service is the majority of their business.
Yeah.
And the 20% is where it's a smaller part of their business. But we think it's a really significant, interesting technology they have that is making a significant contribution to solving the environmental problem. But at the moment, it's a smaller part of the business. And obviously, our hope and expectation would be that in time it would grow to be a bigger part of the business because in all likelihood, it's going to be a very fast-growing part of their business because it's going to be solving an environmental problem.
Yeah, okay. So let's get on to those problems. And so I suppose the starting point for the strategy and process is identifying companies that address environmental problems. And I've seen your work and you've got seven of them. So can you discuss those seven problems that you've identified? And a couple of follow-up questions within it. Is there a desire to seek equal allocation across those seven issues contributing to those environmental problems?
Yes, so we have these seven themes that we've identified. So I'll list them to start with. That'll help to set the scene.
Sure.
So clean energy, water, forestry and agriculture, responsible consumption, clean transport, recycling and the circular economy, and electrification, energy and industrial efficiency. And so to start with, why have we chosen those themes? So really, we've chosen these themes because they address what we think is a wide range of some of the most pressing environmental issues out there and where the biggest environmental problems are. So you know, it's not an exhaustive list of every environmental problem out there, but for us, those are the seven key themes addressing seven significant problems. So, and importantly to say, those also cover both areas like climate change, which is obviously where a lot of the, I guess, the focus is in this environmental space, but also importantly, areas like sort of broader nature areas and biodiversity. Yeah. And, you know, for us, you know, we think that's really important. We think these are mutually reinforcing in a way the areas of biodiversity and climate change.
Mm. And responsible consumption as well would feed into that too.
Absolutely. So some of the more kind of the climate change sectors would be things like clean energy, clean transport are some of the more obvious ones. Mm. But you're absolutely right. Things like responsible consumption, things like recycling, the circular economy, and things also like forestry and agriculture play to a slightly different theme, and particularly things like biodiversity. So, for example, one of the, you know, biodiversity is an area where people find it intuitively harder to think about what are the obvious investment themes. Mm-hmm. For us, we have an independent board that we maybe will touch on later. But within that, we have an ecologist, and we spend a lot of time talking to the ecologist about biodiversity. And his strong conviction is that by far the biggest impact on biodiversity negatively is the impact of mass agriculture. So, for example, if we can find ways to do agriculture more efficiently, whether that's, you know, growing the same amount of product with less land or using less water, less herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, then that is all a very good broad environmental outcome, but also specifically for biodiversity. So those are some of the themes that play to the sort of, you know, more of the biodiversity broader nature rather than necessarily just climate change.
Yeah. No, I know. I think that comes through. And I think you're right that there are many strategies that are probably too focused on the climate change elements. And it's quite refreshing to see that this has got other legs to it as well. So, question, I'm curious about the seven that you've got. I don't know the answer to this, but do any of those objectives conflict with each other?
I don't think they conflict. In many ways, I think they're more complementary. And I think it sort of goes back to what I was saying just now about the fact that we think, you know, they're very sort of interlinked, the themes of biodiversity and climate change. So, for example, and we think that they're mutually dependent and mutually reinforcing. So, for example, you know, climate change leads to damage to ecosystems. Mm. Damaged ecosystems lose their ability to sequester carbon. So, and as they lose their ability to sequester carbon, that in turn leads to more climate change. So we think a lot of these themes are actually very, very complementary and interlinked. So definitely not. And in fact, more so than them being sort of competing, in many cases, we find stocks that actually, you know, we have debates as to which sector they should go in, which themes that they should go in, because they sit across several different themes.
Yeah, fair enough. And so you touched on that advisory board before, and because it's full of industry experts, some very well-credentialed individuals and very experienced. I'm kind of curious. So they obviously helped you with set the seven environmental problems. I'm kind of curious, like, if you can lead us into some of the discussions you're having internally, like what other areas are they talking about that they're saying, maybe you should have a look at this one here. What are some of the emerging thoughts that are coming through?
Yeah, so maybe if I just set the scene a little bit about giving a bit of background about, you know, why we've got a board. So, you know, one of the things that Harry and I, when we launched the strategy, we were very cognizant of the fact that, you know, the technological, regulatory, policy landscape in this space is one that is going to evolve very quickly. And, you know, for us, having an independent advisory board was a great way for us to stay on top of a lot of those trends. So the board's role is to, you know, A, bring insights in their areas of expertise, but also equally importantly, to challenge the investment team on positions we've got in the portfolio. Sure. And really, you know, crucially to ensure that they're meeting our environmental objectives. Mm. And the stocks are aligned with the principles of the fund. So we have these four advisors across four verticals, which are policy, technology, ecology, and green finance. So, and maybe to give you some flavor of some of the discussions. So, you know, under policy, we have a person called Dr. Jun Ma, who's China's most senior green policymaker. We spend a lot of time talking to him about environmental policy coming out of China, but also, you know, broader economic policy coming out of China as well. And clearly, that's been very topical with things like zero COVID, now coming out of zero COVID, but going back specifically in terms of environmental policy, going back to the latest five-year plan and what the environmental objectives were going to be incorporated into that was clearly very important. I mentioned Joe Bull, who's our ecologist just now. So you know, Joe has a specialization in the environmental impact of economic development. And his key area of expertise is looking at things like biodiversity. And as I mentioned earlier, the impact of mass agriculture on biodiversity. So we spend a lot of time talking to him about that. In terms of some other topics, so we have James Brown, who's our technology expert. One of the recent conversations we had with James at our last round of board meetings, which was really fascinating, is James is currently involved in an offshore wind company. And we asked him to take us through a case study of actually what is involved in getting a wind farm from concept of idea to, you know, turning it on, all the steps involved. So, you know, that was through, you know, concept, environmental permitting, procurement, well, final investment decision, procurement, and then, you know, all the issues associated with connecting to the grid, et cetera, all the way through to turning the wind farm on. And for us, it was fascinating because, you know, with the best will in the world, Harry and I and the rest of the investment team, we've never opened a wind farm. We sit in a desk. And so that gave us a very kind of interesting insight into actually the practicalities of what's actually involved. To sort of topics you were talking about, the some of the recent discussions. I mean, I think nuclear has been a really interesting discussion we've had because I think, it's been an evolving debate we've had with the board. I think nuclear tends to divide opinion quite a bit. For us, we've always been pretty clear that we think nuclear is an environmental solution, but we definitely wanted to debate with the board, that, you know, that was our view, our belief, but we wanted to debate it with the board and see if they agreed and to kind of flesh out some of the controversies. And actually, as it happened, the board were universally behind our view as well, that nuclear, we think, is an environmental solution. And I mention that because it's very topical, because attitudes towards nuclear have changed quite a lot over the last 12, 18 months with things like the energy crisis in Europe, for example. And that's definitely leading to some changing thinking around attitudes to nuclear. So we think nuclear is an investable theme. Unfortunately, it's hard for us to find ideas to invest. So we currently don't actually have any exposure in the nuclear space.
And out of curiosity, timeline wise, because SFDR brought that in to classify that nuclear is clean energy. So did that come pre or post Ukraine war commencing?
I don't know the answer to that question, to be precise around the timing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, because, and obviously it's a big piece that people are working through now and definitely are getting on there. You also touched on China and, well, I suppose emerging markets are imbued in that one there, because probably a lot of strategies that we see out there are very developed market focused. So do you think that you've got a better handle on the emerging market sphere?
Definitely. I mean, I think for us, again, when Harry and I were designing the product, we always felt that having a good exposure or at least good capability to invest in emerging markets was really important. And the reason that is the case is because so much of the, you know, important technology areas of development in a lot of the environmental space is happening in emerging markets. So pretty much 100% of the global solar value chain comes out of China. Pretty much 100% of the global EV battery chain comes out of Northern Asia in one form or another. So if you're not investing in emerging markets, you're not capturing a lot of that.
Yeah.
Okay. And the other aspect of why we think emerging markets is important, because they have a lot of the best renewable assets around the world. So, you know, if there are wind farms and solar farms, they don't tend to be in Melbourne or indeed in London. You know, they tend to be often in emerging markets. They might be in South America. They might be in the Indian subcontinent, for example. So again, you know, often if we're investing in a renewable generating company, they may not have, you know, their assets may actually be in emerging markets. So for us, having an understanding of the local dynamics in that market are very important. So that's why we think investing in emerging markets is really important. But crucially, we're also aware of some of the pitfalls that can come with investing in emerging markets. In certain countries, there can be, you know, elevated governance concerns, for example. So for us, you know, crucially, we think we're very well placed to invest in emerging markets. Emerging markets is the biggest part of TT's business. So, it's by far the largest, piece of our assets under management. We have a very large and successful emerging market strategy with a very strong investment team. Crucially, you mentioned SFDR just now. We've relatively recently launched an Article 8 version of that emerging market strategy.
Okay.
So that gives you a sense of how important ESG more broadly is within that emerging market strategy, and obviously also the focus within environmental within that. So that means that, you know, absolutely incorporating things like putting the highest standards in terms of governance, social, as well as environmental, are absolutely critical to what we've done in emerging markets. Therefore, we have that capability, we have that expertise that when we're going into investing in emerging markets, we're doing it with that resource and able to be very eyes wide open about the potential pitfalls and risks in emerging markets, and very well placed to kind of address those and be on top of them. Mm. And importantly, also, you know, Harry and I are both based in London, but we have a broad-based team. Specifically, we have four analysts based out of our Hong Kong office, three of whom just look at China. So you mentioned China just now. You know, China is a very important market for us. You know, we definitely feel at all times we want to balance the opportunities in China with some of the negatives around China, you know, potentially elevated geopolitical risk, for example. Mm. We do think China is an important market, and therefore having that dedicated resource, three analysts just looking at China based in Hong Kong, we think is incredibly important. It would totally lack credibility if we were doing that from London, obviously.
Yeah. No, fair enough. So I just want to turn a bit I think it's an interesting topic, which is around data and measurement, because this is, I suppose, one of the things that people are asking about, you know, what are the outcomes? And it's because everyone wants to see the proof and the outcomes of the strategies that they're creating impact. So just broadly, before we get on to, you know, I'm sure you'll talk us through, you know, some of those measurement elements, but kind of take us back about, how do you collect all the relevant data and how much effort is involved to collect all that data?
It's an interesting question, and it's a very good topic to discuss, because I think, you know, it's definitely a good question to ask. How do you actually measure and quantify the impact you're having, with this investment strategy? And I think I'd make a few points. You know, definitely, in the broader concept of having impact, I think there are, you know, there are some important points to make. I think first and foremost, we absolutely recognize that the concept of having impact and claiming impact when you're buying and selling secondary market equities is a bit nebulous. You know, claiming that we're saving however many tons of carbon by investing a certain number of shares in such and such a company, I think is a bit of a tenuous claim. We do think, you know, we do have direct impact through participating in primary capital raisings, and we have participated in a few IPOs, but much more significantly, actually, we've participated in follow-on capital raises for companies that are already listed, where they're raising capital to accelerate their environmental investments, for example. So, you know, definitely, in as far as we are providing primary capital to accelerate that green transition, that is definitely having impact. To your question of how do we measure that impact, though, that's very difficult. You know, we're alongside a lot of other investors providing that primary capital. And, you know, potentially this might be to be build such and such a factory, you know, making, you know, the next generation of electric vehicles. The factory won't be completed for 3-4 years. The vehicles will then be sold over a long period of time. So it's very difficult for us to measure that and to quantify it, but we can claim that we're having impact. I think some of the other areas where we look at also having direct where we can measure how much impact we're having is we look at this concept called avoided emissions. Mm. You know, there are some caveats around the data in terms of avoided emissions. And it's to your point about, you know, how much resource and time does it take to look at this data? a lot of the avoided emissions data is self-disclosed by companies. So we put a lot of effort in scrutinizing the methodology and making sure that it stacks up is logical. But in the vast majority of cases, you know, we're satisfied that that is the case. We then aggregate that data and we look across our portfolio and look at measuring not just the carbon emitted, so the carbon footprint of our fund, but also avoided emissions. And the reason this is important, particularly for this strategy, is that because this is a solution strategy, I said before, it's not a low carbon strategy, it's a solution strategy. So in many cases, we're investing in companies that are industrial processes that are making these products products or that are solving the environmental problems. And therefore, those industrial processes have a carbon footprint. Mm. And therefore, we're not going to be the lowest carbon fund around. But in all the companies where we're investing, where they have a carbon footprint, we're 100% confident that there is a very significant net environmental gain. And one way of looking at that is through this concept of avoided emissions. So to give you an example, the area of insulation, which we think is a really interesting theme. Buildings account for something like 30% of global emissions, mainly through heating and cooling them. So having buildings properly insulated is a really cost-effective way to materially reduce emissions. Now, the process of making insulation, depending on which type of insulation it is, can be very energy intensive. And at the most energy intensive end is mineral wall insulation, where so there's a company called Rockwool. We don't currently own it in the portfolio, but that makes stone wall insulation. It is very energy intensive, the process, but they had an independent management consultant did their avoided emissions data, and they calculated that the carbon saved over the life of the product is 100 times more than the carbon emitted in the production process.
And so what's the lifespan on that kind of insulation?
So off the top of my head, I don't know exactly what life cycle they were using for stonewall insulation, but I would guess that would have been 20, 30 years, something like that. So if we look at our fund, so roughly half the companies that we own have a disclosed avoided emissions number. Yep. And if we just take that avoided emissions data from half the portfolio and compare it to 100% of the portfolio, which has a carbon emitted data, we find that gives an answer of 23 times. So that means that the carbon avoided, the carbon saved, is 23 times the carbon emitted across our companies. So, directionally, we think that's very clear. Whether, as I said, these numbers are self-disclosed. So whether that number's 15 or 30, there clearly can be some debate around the quantum of the number, but I think the directionality is clear.
Mm. And is the quality of disclosure and data provided by companies, has that been getting better over time?
Definitely. I think in all areas associated with this environmental space, that the quality of the data is improving, and that's partly because the companies recognize that they have to, and partly because investors such as us are putting pressure on them to make sure that the quality
and
of the data.
And I suppose they get into a rigor as well too, because they're getting used to supply and they're probably getting better too.
Exactly. And for a lot of companies, particularly we find, with emerging market companies, is that actually they are, potentially further behind, if you like, in terms of areas like disclosure versus a lot of developed market companies, because I think developed equity markets have been further advanced in terms of areas like disclosure and investors putting pressure on the companies to disclose more. So one of the areas we spend a lot of time is engaging with the companies in emerging markets precisely to get them to improve their disclosure, which is often in their best interest. In fact, in the vast majority of cases, in their best interest, because it's just that, they have good data, they have a good story to tell, but often they haven't done the work, they haven't done the analysis, and they haven't published the data. So, it's a sort of softer area of engagement, but it's an area we've actually had a lot of success is persuading these companies to improve their disclosure.
Oh, very good. So we'll get towards the end on this one here. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I think worthy of a follow-up one as well too. And when I looked at this strategy, I thought, one of the unique elements to this TT business and the strategy is the donating a one-third of investment management fees to environmental causes. And, I suppose that's probably another part of the impact of the difference that you're making as well. So can you tell me how that came about and how you select the causes and what kind of outcomes you've observed through this program?
Yes. Well, it really came about going back to the conversation we were just having about impact as well. So, you know, in a way, acknowledging what I was saying about, you know, buying and selling secondary market equities, and the potential claims around having impact there can be a bit tenuous. I've talked about the other ways we definitely are having impact. Mm. But another way to kind of cut through that debate is we thought with a charitable donation, we can have clear, irrefutable, direct impact. And, you know, I should also say you were talking about in terms of measuring impact, you know, that's something very clear that we can measure. We know exactly how much we have given to these charities. And, by the end of this quarter, by the end of this month, we think that figure will have got up to about $500,000 that we will have given to environmental charities that are aligned with the principles of the fund. And I should also say that, you know, if we're successful in scaling the fund to where we think we can, that will be a very significant annual annuity, in terms of charitable donations that are having real direct impact. So that was really the genesis of why we wanted to do it. In terms of, how we've chosen the strategies and how we've chosen to allocate that, those charitable donations. So we have a charity committee, internal charity committee, which I'm not on, I hasten to add. Mm-hmm. So they do a lot of due diligence looking at potential charities, where might be the most impactful donations that we can give. One of the other things is we are definitely looking to align our charitable donations that are relevant, you know, align them to and that are relevant to our investors. So, you know, as an example, Australia is a really important market for us. We recognize that early on the strategy. So we've deliberately chosen one of our charitable partners is an Australian charity. It's the University of Western Australia Oceans Institute, which does marine research. So that's a little bit about how we've chosen the strategies to make sure they're aligned with the interests of the fund and also aligned with the interests of our investors. And in terms of measuring the impact out of our charitable donations, you know, obviously there's a huge range of charities. There's a huge range of what they do. You know, one of the things that we also want to do in selecting the charities is actually have charities where we can actually have an impact. So our donations are actually going to make a difference. So, you know, we don't necessarily want to be investing in the world's largest environmental charities because actually they're potentially the people who don't need our money. Yeah. We're going to have more impact with some smaller charities. And as a good example here, one of our charitable partners is a rewilding charity called Heal Rewilding in the UK. And they've just recently bought their first site. They've been around for 2 or 3 years. They were a partner of ours right from the beginning of the strategy. They literally just bought their first site, which is a large plot of land in Somerset in the UK, which they're now going to rewild. And, you know, one of the really gratifying things about that is that TT's charitable donation formed the vast majority of the equity they used to buy that site. So, you know, I don't think it's overstating it to say that had we not been their charitable partner,
you've made an impact.
They would not have been able to buy that site. So, you know, for us, it's a small example, but it's a very real example about actually having impact.
Agreed. No, that was excellent, Andy. Thank you very much. We will wrap it up there. Please come and see us again next time you're in Melbourne.
I'd love to. And thanks again for having me.
Thanks.